Well, welcome. I hope you're each doing great and have had a super Memorial Day holiday until now, at least. Again, my apologies that I didn't notice this earlier to schedule around it. I appreciate those of you who are in attendance and those of you who have sent feedback, follow-up, and questions in between seminars. Is there something, and remember, we are going to have a discussion after our seminar today or at the end of it at the top of the hour for those of you who'd like to hang around and just have a discussion, ask questions or comments, and elaborate or expand on some things that might be of help and application to you for you and for your coaching. Anything to begin? Questions, thoughts, anything you'd like to discuss before we initiate our final money seminar? I'm eager to hear how each of you are finding this, if it's meeting your expectations, if there are still things you'd like to discuss. If you don't have something immediately, I'd like to hear from you at the end of the presentation. Additional things you'd like to talk more about. I know one of the things that we have in the hopper is about professional fees, and we'll discuss that some more. If you want to add anything, do that, jot it down, or even log it in now if you want to have a brief discussion now, or just put it in queue for a later discussion. Anything at all from any of you? Well, I hope you're finding this useful and applicable, and I look forward to a more back-and-forth discussion. I'll unless there is something you'd like to add or ask or comment on, I'll go ahead and start with our with the presentation. Final call. Anything you'd like to discuss briefly before we start? Okay, I'll put us on presentation mode. Hold on. Okay, we're going to talk about the final two steps, kind of mind over money matters. Step six, author new experiences, and step seven in the roadmap about revising identity. I'll do a brief overview and review at the end, but I want to move right into step six about authoring new experiences. This is about really bringing about the changes that we understand, plan, and create in a system. Now, basically, remember we talked about how the idea of story, money story, wellness story, our life story, that's our metaphor as coaches. For our client, they don't experience it as a story. They don't think about a money story. It's just the way things are. And we come to trust our stories. They're our reality. If our stories and our behaviors don't fit, we experience disharmony. We have to change one or the other then to restore that balance. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we change how we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early, or you'll stop yourself and label it as procrastination. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's look now at the dynamics of change, because I think this may be important as you're listening to your story, your client's story, to look at and understand some of the things that inform that and are the backdrop. So looking at the dynamics of change, and then in a moment we'll look at transition and how that's different, how that's a process. But first, the idea of change is going to create excitement. That's the what's next. That's the hit of dopamine. Then, as it's on the cusp of action, as you're about to take that first step, anxiety, or at least uncertainty and trepidation, because it's new and different. Then, ultimately, the action, the expansion, and finally, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that I want to highlight as coaches, because they may seem paradoxical, and certainly for your clients they may. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. So someone must mourn, they must say goodbye, emotionally as well as practically, to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. Now, this is a process, it's a developmental step, not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior, or a hope that by getting the story just right or doing it a little bit better, it's going to make it work. No matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. And that's also because the old story is part of an identity. That's the bedrock of an operating system. We're going to return to that. The more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change can be an injury to self-esteem. Now, that really seems paradoxical, but this carefully crafted old story with some aspects of identity attached is replaced by something better. So it means that I could have been doing better all along. Man, why didn't I see this earlier? So there are at least six components to this dynamic of change, and I want to spell them out. They're not going to appear, and it's not going to be something you're going to, you know, share with your clients, but it's, I think, important in recognizing a process to really fashion both your understanding and then what you do about it as a catalyst for the client story. Now, these are not headlines. These are not things you're going to see that you can label, but just to think about, they're sort of like internal conceptual markers. First, the myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness in adulthood. The development, the recognition that nobody's going to take care of it for you. This is the final step into adulthood, to recognize that nobody's going to take care of it for you. The growth, to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation, the combination often of a happy, sad experience, happy about the autonomy, the effectiveness of moving ahead, and the effectiveness also of not constructing an obstacle, but sad about mourning an old story, that you're giving up a part of who you were, a part of the past. Here are some illustrations. I mentioned earlier that there's a list in your resources section in the outline about the ABCs of financial mistakes. I just want to highlight some. These are maybe some of the ones you're going to most likely hear, but I want to highlight them to get you interested enough to read the ones that I've enumerated in your material so that you'll recognize them when your clients, or God forbid, you begin to use any of them. Now, this is a way of organizing the most common financial mistakes and money issues in order to get a better level of understanding. The compromised money behaviors and financial decisions can fall into one of four categories. There are lumpers and splitters. I'm a lumper. That means I'm lumping this into four things to organize it to make it maybe more accessible. The ABCs, the affect, the behavior, the cognitive, and the social biases. So I want to give a couple of examples of each just to give you an idea of how this may show itself. One the affect, the emotional bias. One is a nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at really difficult times. We want to go back to a better time. Nostalgia, though, remembers things not as they were, but as we wish them to be. They're airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. For example, has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go on? Are less popular in memory replays? I know I'm very close to being All-State in basketball twice in one season, as I recall, probably by next year. And that was the season we were undefeated, by the way, too. Now, marketing taps into nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memories than to create a new product identification. The nostalgic trigger is overlaid with new information. It boots up a whole mindset. The coupling uses nostalgia to influence current choice. Arnold Palmer and that old tractor. Two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. Another, invincibility bias. As adolescents especially, and in some ways it still holds on, the seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality that we all have when we were young. And, again, there's still whispers in adulthood. Here are some examples. 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. That was a large study survey. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. 75% of all adults believe they're healthier than average. Some behavior biases. One example is transference fallacy. Now, I made that up, but transference comes from psychoanalysis, the tendency to redirect feelings from a past context to a current one is considered a transference. It's really using old expired software for a current experience and recognizing that it doesn't work. One example, Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline in the first hour of the stock market opening. Hewlett-Packard collapsed half of its value the same day. There was no relationship whatsoever except that they were both big box computer companies at the time. And both rebounded, but there was a big emotional reaction. Spending justification is a behavior bias, creating a just cause to spend. Somebody takes money from retirement savings to spend with a justification of an immediate need being greater than the abstract future need of retirement. So the coaching question may be, how will you repay it? Now, if someone does internal bargaining to say, well, I'll pay it back next week or next paycheck, or it may be vaguely dismissed with a vow to return the money at some future point. Neither is a plan. Status quo bias. Resistance to leaving a comfort zone. This is contributed to by both brain and mind software. The status quo bias is another name for inertia. The default option is to stay in our comfort zone, to do nothing. Let me give you an example of this. Marketers know when they give a three-month free trial, it's called a forced free trial, because you have to give your credit card number to the company and you get 3 months of a free trial. If you don't unsubscribe at the end of 3 months, they start sending you the subscription. Almost 80% of the initial free subscribers stay on for the long haul, and between 67 and 69% of those people never read the subscription. But it's because of this inertia, this status quo bias. Now, the power of inertia can be strategically fashioned to produce better outcomes. You can set the program, the status quo, to make a good choice. And it's a choice I mentioned earlier. You can set up an automatic enrollment savings program for retirement. You can set that up. You don't have to work for a company. You set it up to have it withdrawn from your checking account first day of every month and go automatically into your retirement account. One decision. Here's an example of cognitive bias involving money. First, diagnosis bias. If you label a person or a situation or boot up a particular mindset and then seek data to confirm it, this is a confirmation bias coupled with blindness to anything that contradicts that belief. Here's a real-life example of that. Two economists, Barry Staw and Ha Huang, have studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players. They did this for a five-year period, and they distilled statistics into distinct skill-measuring categories like scoring, quickness, toughness. They looked at all the variables that determined playing time in games, skill categories, performance, injury, trade status. There was one variable that had far and away the greatest impact of any of these actual performance data. It was the player's draft selection order. Now, logically, draft order should be more highly correlated with playing time initially, but then through 5 years, that would dissipate and it would be actual performance in all those categories. But even though skill and performance determines a draft order, coaches and managers would stay with that concept of the draft order, that once the draft is over, the draft numbers history and performance. Not so, says diagnosis bias, because people still used that mindset for the first 5 years of playing time. Here's an example of social biases. Affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of things we like. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like, such as foreign enemies and out-of-favor investment. Here's an example. You bet $20 on a favorite in the Super Bowl and lose. Well, that's unlucky. But you lose $1,500 betting on your alma mater would win their college game, even though they're dead last in the division. That's affinity bias. Emotional overlay, in other words. Loss aversion. Selling a loser admits defeat. We tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much bad feeling associated with losing $100 as there is good feeling in gaining $100. And that's measurable at a brain level. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize in economics for the mathematical breakthrough showing how to calculate trade-off between risk and return in portfolio selection of stocks. He admitted, though, that he didn't apply it to his own portfolio. He said, I visualized my grief if the stock market went up and I wasn't in it, or if it went way down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret. Of course, he insured his future loss of benefit in that way. And that relates to a couple of things that I think you'll see again and again in your work with clients. There are two primary motivators that we have as humans, to seek pleasure and to avoid pain. And as we just said, seeking avoiding pain is about twice as powerful as seeking pleasure. So if you play not to lose, that boots up the whole mindset of avoiding pain. And the results tend to be significantly less in a number of ways for both performance and outcome than when you seek to gain pleasure, to play to win. Now, this is something that we do in that we can do in coaching. For example, if your client has planned something and made a commitment but not done it, so you know the system is there. First question is, do you have a plan? And then do you stick to it? If the answer is yes to both, then you may look at what the shadow story is of why your client stopped doing what they commit to do. It may be what they assume to be avoiding pain. And if they stop themselves, the assumption, unspoken, maybe even unconscious, might be something along the shadow storylines of what we talked about in the first seminar. I don't think I could do it. What if I put myself out and do my best and still don't do it? What if I let, you know, a number of things that makes it make sense to stop, but doesn't even have to be conscious. So a question here at this juncture is, what would be the greater pain if you don't do it? And the other coaching inquiry might be to couple it with, what would be the greater gain if you do follow through? So that someone looks closely instead of automatically in that default mode at the choice architecture of this moment, this decision point. What if you do? What if you don't? What's the greater pleasure if you do? What's the greater pain if you don't? To look at the next step and the potential next step in terms of whether you do or don't take it. So let's look now at the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story. One, not knowing that you don't know. Now, how can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which can blind us to our ignorance. This, in turn, causes us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. So to know to ask is half the answer. This is our role as coaches. This is why powerful questions can be important in this way too, to look at the beliefs, at the reasons that someone makes their choices so automatically without thinking about it. I believe that whatever it is. So you may ask, yeah, but how do you know? If you want to get at someone's belief, ask them how they really know. Ask them to elaborate on that. What are the, you wouldn't ask it in this way, but what are the data that force the conclusion? How do they come to that? Those automatic decisions are what we perturbate as coaches, the script that someone has about how they and others should automatically respond. We get paid well for perturbating that story and for asking questions that someone doesn't quite know the answer to, but they do it collaboratively with us in this alliance to understand better. Second most frequent mistake. These are not in statistical order, but number two, okay, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, that can be a correct strategy, but it also can stop us from considering other right answers, other correct or better strategies that could be more effective. So then we may ask, what else? And then what? Or is there another way of thinking about this? Now, I'll introduce number three with a brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, planned their strategy, created the steps exactly as they were going to do, and then decided they would jump off. So how many were left on the log? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided, create a strategy, but they didn't commit to act. So number three can be procrastination or the failure of the system to include the final step of the action. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns, putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as if there were an unlimited amount of time left. Now, we know logically and intellectually that life is finite and all that, but we may have little sense of urgency, and that can contribute to a lack of focus. Now, consider this. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in the final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. Not the Houston Texans, but most other teams. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases effort. Now, in our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but may not really internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. 4. Inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key component to success. This begins with knowing your strengths, your limitations, your biological cycles, when you perform best, and creating a systematic way to practice and perform. Know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which works best for a particular task. For example, writing, editing, two different states of mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at different times. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind. Some of these principles are ones that I've derived from working with other professionals, including coaches, who have attention deficit challenges. These are particularly useful for people who tend to not do as well managing attention and are easily distracted. Identify what enhances your energy, anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. Identify what depletes your energy, like toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can add to decision paralysis. What looks like resistance in your client may simply be a lack of clarity or specificity about what the next step is. So that may be a question that you want to ask your client, what is the next step? I'm going to come back to that as I answer one of the questions that was sent in at the beginning about fees. So put an asterisk by that. People are more likely to change when new behavior is crystal clear, not vague or abstract. Eating a healthier diet is vague and abstract. The possibilities of eat healthier or save for the future are limitless. Where do you begin with that? Make sure that when your client hangs up the phone or logs off from the session with you, they know specifically what to do next and what to do after that. You may even need to ask them. We're going to come back to that too. When you want to affect change, the scripting of specific behaviors needs to be a collaborative effort led by, initiated by, with the point of reference being your client. 6, too many choices. Again, most frequent mistakes in writing a new money story. 6, too many choices. Some studies have shown how an HR department or individual investment advisor can provide too many choices and the extra options backfire, leading to decision paralysis. For every 10 options offered, the employee's rate of participation goes down by 2%. Here's a simpler example, because at some point choice debilitates rather than liberates, and somebody retreats to a default mode of not making a choice. Think about, this is an experience we've all had. We look at something, and then there are some choices, and the choices are a little bit hard to understand, and, well, I think I'll just take a nap. Now, a classic study in decision paralysis was done at a gourmet grocery store. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. On an alternate weekend at each of the stores, there were 24 jams available for tasting. And for both of the weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. So equal motivation both ways. While the display of jams of 24 attracted more potential customers, when 24 varieties were available for tasting, 3% of the customers purchased a jam. When there are only 6 varieties available for tasting, 30% purchased a jam. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone to do nothing, to embrace that status quo. So this is, you know, in mentor coaching with coaches in their startup at times, I will simply get them to look at what about how they're thinking about offering choices and packages and that sort of thing, and get them to think about the client who knows nothing about choices, who does not have the information to make an informed choice. Wouldn't it be easier to treat it like any other professional who you can consult, that you have a discussion, and you as the professional coach, like a doctor, a dentist, an attorney, a lawyer, makes a recommendation of a particular way to proceed and what's involved with that. Not packages, not choices, not the platinum, gold, or silver plan. You get 5 more emails if you do the silver. You, as a professional, do an assessment, make a recommendation. We'll go over some of that in the discussion if you're interested. 7, lack of persistence. The truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the willingness to stay the course. In Angela Duckworth's term and book title, grit, it's a particular kind of resilience. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion, can cut through the fog like a beacon in the night. One extra degree of effort in business and in life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who decided then to publish the book himself and sell it out of the trunk of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. He's since sold $1.5 billion worth of books. To get what you've never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Lord Eliot put it in a very simple way. Perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. So success is never final. Don't get complacent. Testing is as important as postulating and planning. Test ideas out, revise them. Make it your story, told with your voice. Proceed organically. Here's how a fellow Texan, Ross Perot, said, most people give up when they're about to achieve success. They quit on the 1-yard line. Another, number 8, not following success trails. Have you ever heard some version of this? Well, I want to change careers, but I don't know what I do instead. I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not sure what it is. I want to generate wealth, but I don't have a plan. One thing you may want to do is pick some success trails to follow, to look at people who have succeeded and look at how you can incorporate the model yourself in your own way. One example, when my good buddy Art heard that I was transitioning from psychoanalytic practice, had completed my professional coach training, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. A few years earlier, he had left a very senior position at IBM as the lead healthcare industry person in the country at IBM at that time, to start his own private consultation firm. He told me how he chose five very successful people, asked them to lunch or dinner, and pick their brains about what he was about to do, best ideas, practices, that sort of thing. He advised me to do the same. And he said, I can count him. I only have to do four more after that. It worked for both of us. Some business people with instant global recognition still pick his brain for substantial picking fees. Even think about creating a support team, constructing an advisory board, a networking group, engage a mentor, join a mastermind group. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. There does not have to be a split between spirituality and money. Spirituality and profitability can be very compatible. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? Here are some synonyms: abundance, wealth, spirituality. Here are some antonyms: suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. Now, remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are also synonyms. One thing that I believe you will improve your health by creating less stress, as stress causes the body to be less healthy, you will create an attitude and an experience of abundance, which will enhance wellness and begin a mindset for a current, very informed money story. Now, I want to note here, but not go into it, but just reference, there's a detailed outline in your workbook about visualizations and affirmations. This is something that we know now in the last decade and a half, how visualizations rewire the brain and affirmations revise mind software to create the story to support the visualization. Both approaches are systematic, informed by neuroscience, and are in that outline. And I would suggest you look at them. For some clients, there may be a use for visualization. So, again, affirmations reprogram your mind, visualizations rewire your brain. And here's an illustration. Some of you have heard me tell this story. Our possibilities are only limited to the ones we allow ourselves to see. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was imprisoned, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had 299s. Everything else was triple digits. He realized that in order to really maintain his sanity and to stay grounded, he would need to do visualization, being trapped in a cell 24 hours a day. He didn't know it was going to be 7 years, but it ended up being 7 years. So each day, he decided to get up in his mind and play golf. He would get up, dress, imagine driving to his favorite golf course, visualized warming up, making each stroke, going to the ball, taking in the landscape. He played golf 7 to 8 hours a day, every day, for 7 years. When he was released, his first outing, he shot a 74. So, here's an overview of the 7 steps. And we've been talking about the final step of reprogramming your identity. We're talking about it in each aspect that we've been doing. This is something that I think I can't emphasize the importance enough of this final step of programming new identity. With each step in progress by your client, how we can help them transform how and who they see themselves to be, their operating system is important to make change permanent, because unless change is permanent, they're going to revert back to their old behavior. And the way to make it permanent is to revise that core sense of identity, of how and who someone is, their basic operating system. So with each step, we may highlight a progress, a different way of looking at things, and collaboratively look together at how they're doing, seeing, feeling differently, them developing self-empathy and the self-reflection and self-observation that we're doing together, they will internalize. We can foster that. How did you experience doing that in that new way? Now, what were you thinking and feeling as you did that? That must be a really exciting, or whatever you sense that to be, an empathic resonance that can help someone develop their own increasing sense of both self-reflection and of empathic resonance with themselves. The purpose of empathy is not an end in itself, but it's a means to a better end, because the client is also downloading the model of what we're doing with them and our work with them to revise the model of how and who they are. It's kind of like, as parents, we didn't know exactly what was important and what was going to be remembered. That means everything is. I've heard Lindsey Vonn, the best women's skier in the world, say, every word matters, in reference to coaches, mentors, people giving feedback. Everything we do matters, and that's important because our client is internalizing that process that we co-create and develop with them, and that reprograms their identity, because that's the most powerful force in the human psyche. We always return to our identity, so that's why it has to transform and be the new bedrock to make that the new automatic and default mode. So those considerations are important in this final step. So as an overview, and we can return to this if it would be helpful to do so. An overview of the seven steps then. We've examined in your story money as reality and metaphor, the path as well as the possession, the power we give it, and its own power. Now, we've taken this journey in a way to develop these seven steps: to recognize authorship, to own your story, assess the plot and the storylines, to decide what to change, to map changes, author new experiences, and finally to program new identity, to incorporate the change as your true self, to transform the identity of being the new story. So in these seven steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, and how a bunch of other things hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps deconstruct how you write your money story and live it, or provide a method to examine the system of looking at and creating revisions or a new story. They're building blocks to revise a story or write a new one. So I want to highlight a couple of things about engineering effectiveness, how we can, as coaches, facilitate a better grasp of this, a better performance. So some essentials in engineering an effective story, and here we're talking about money story. Make changes tangible and concrete. Remember we talked about create a map. Every coaching session is a map. What would you like to focus on? Where would you like to get to? And then we specifically help the client develop that story and create a new model of self-reflection, examination, and system creation in the process. And the changes need to be, even the focus needs to be tangible and concrete. To construct a yardstick, a map, to determine where you are, where you're going, to measure progress along the way, that lets you tell what's deter and distraction. And the beauty of a map, again, is all the stuff you don't pay attention to. Same with the focus. All the stuff you don't pay attention to. Think about the model that you already have, I'll bet, of exquisite and successful focus. Think about your mindfulness meditation. When you focus on relaxation, only on your breath, about breathing in and breathing out, and the sensation, experience, relaxation of that specific focus only on your breath and the experience of breathing in relaxation, of breathing out any tension. If you have a thought, which you naturally will because that's the job description of the brain, you figure out using your own system, if you're a visual person, let it float away and refocus on your breath. Have your own way to disengage as quickly as you can to move back to just your breath. It's a model of focus. It's also a model of how you stay focused on a client. The equivalent there, especially in the beginning, is, God, what should I be asking now? I wonder if that's the thought you let float away, refocus on your client and on the story you're co-creating. It's always about your client. It's never about you. Any thought, negative self-talk, disengage it. Refocus on your client. Two, make progress measurable. Demystify the journey, a specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. Three, make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones that are invisible and probably useful with your client to celebrate each small victory. This is exactly what your client will need to do when they're by themselves and you're not on the horizon, because what you do is the model that's internalized. You celebrate the victory, and then with a growth mindset, ask the question, what's next? Those two, the reward and the dopamine hit for what's next, what more can you ask of a mind and a brain and a plan than that? Four, specify the next step. And some of this is so simple, but it still bears saying, not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. All you ever need to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to the immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum, of mastery. One of the best examples of shrinking a task to a tangible next item to create a new systematic way of doing things is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenged its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to manageable, foreseeable, specific action. What are you going to do tomorrow? One day at a time. I'm refocusing on right now. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. So, and at times you may need to do, you know, the next 5 minutes, depending on what you're doing. We've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change, and the impact, the evidence of that change. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry automatically generates discomfort because that disrupts the script, that disrupts the status quo, but it also catalyzes growth. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the self, the sense of self, resides in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect and make assessments and judgments regarding themselves. This is also the part of the brain when an fMRI scan is measuring activity here, and people are given however many different objects to purchase. The predictability is way more than 90% about which of 10, say, objects in one of the neuroeconomics studies that someone's going to purchase. It's the specific object that lights up the sense of self that someone identifies with. That's what they're going to purchase, what they identify with that's consistent with their sense of self. So this is why we can be very immensely helpful knowing this in mentor coaching, because we are helping someone evolve and define and expand a current, more effective sense of self. This is the bedrock operating system that we're dealing with in coaching. A recent study found something also important. The more clearly and fully that you can picture your future self, the more money you save for the future. This first, Emily Pronin at Princeton, did this study to show that when someone can actually visualize their future self, the people who can visualize their future self save three times more for the future than people who can't really quite grasp that and do that. Now, Stanford did some interesting studies of age progression, starting with money, or starting with age and savings, and found almost the same findings. When there's age progression, someone will, when they see their 90-year-old self, will save significantly more money. They're also doing things on age progression, like, you know, if you're a smoker, age progress 10, 20, 30, 40 years ahead, what does it look like compared to if you stop smoking right now? Same way with healthy diet and working out. If you gain 1 pound a year, well, that's nothing, but wait a minute. 30 years from now, you see it. So it becomes very, very real. So the more you identify with your future self, the more your decisions, including financial, will have long-term benefits. So here's a review of some guidelines. I want to wrap up and move to our discussion and save time for a final brief story. You didn't think you'd get away without one more story. A review of some guidelines. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. You are helping your client listen for their story more clearly and carefully. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it. Plan it, map it, and tell it. Initiates its creation. You put it in the output channel. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way in response to the story is the response to the story you're telling. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell that story so it shifts your feeling and thinking into a different action. This means that responses from others are not in the equation of that creation. This new telling has to be in alignment with who you are, especially your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and a full purposeful direction of your energy field going forward. So all of you is going in the same direction. That's why with most of my clients, I'll get them to fill out the needs and ideals exercise at the beginning so that together when we look at strategies and plans and what they want to do, it's going to be in alignment with their needs and ideals so that all of them is going in the same direction. When you practice the story that resonates with who you really are, your full energy and power become activated. All of you, again, is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going, where you're going, and be loyal to the resilience of the strategies and the system to get you there. And also flexible enough to recognize if there's a revision that's needed. Know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So, here's a final story. For tens of thousands of years, before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, illuminated the future. Story allowed us to connect with each other's humanity in the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibility. Stories are a way we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. And here's a final quote. This is from Bob Brasney. This may be the turning point your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you leap over the abyss to the other side of the great divide and begin your life in earnest. On the other hand, this moment of truth may end up being nothing more than a brief awakening when you glimpse what's possible on the other side of the great divide, but tell yourself, nah, that's way too far to jump. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content talking about what delicious cookies you used to bake or what your favorite sports team was. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm eager to hear from you and your thoughts and questions. What you got? Any thoughts about what you're taking away? Is this what you expected? And are you finding that an expectation of what you take away is there, or is it different?
Hi, Dave. It's Amy.
Hi, this is who?
Amy, can you hear
Welcome.
Me okay?
Hey, yeah, I sure can.
Thanks.
Great, go ahead, Amy. Thanks.
Thank you. So what I'm taking away from this is actually different, but only in that it's deeper and more comprehensive than what I thought I'd be getting. I'm finding from each of the classes there have been nuggets that have been aha moments, real time for me as a person. And so I, even if I don't use this material with my clients, and I only have one client at the moment because I'm just starting, but I can certainly imagine practicing with these ideas for myself and then hopefully subsequently using them. So,
okay,
you.
And thank you for sending in your question about unraveling beliefs about money that you may not know about.
Yeah.
Did mm-hmm. the money mistakes and financial fallacies did it help with that to kind of illuminate some things that you might be able to think about differently, knowing how those things manifest?
It did, and I'm not sure if what I'm going to mention comes out of what you just, the two kind of categories that you just mentioned, but the thing that got me in the very early part of your discussion was the adulthood piece of it, that nobody will take care of this for you. And I think I have operated under this sort of, I'll call it a childish hope that I don't actually have to think about these things. And so that statement gave me a little bit of permission to be a little bit more active in my role in my financial life.
That's a really stellar insight. And I want to take that and move it to a way that you and every one of us will see that in coaching sessions, where there will be a subtle manifestation, depending on the person, but a subtle way that the client may have to get us to function for them, to want to give them solutions or answers or ideas, rather than them struggling and giving it back to them to look at further exploration and ways of creating their own answers. Because whenever we give a client an answer or a suggestion, or even camouflage a suggestion of, have you thought about, then it immediately closes over the process for both coach and client. So it immediately feels more comfortable because it's a closure. There's not that dissonance that both coach and client have of not knowing and exploring, and we want closure, and we create closure even if it's not cause and effect. There's some incredibly illuminating studies about that. But that's one way that a client can subtly, without even knowing it, create a way to get us to help them close off something and give our answer, and it's like it's done, but it may not be the full development of their own story. So I think that this is a more subtle way of saying what you're saying, which I think is really important, because so much of what we come to know about a client is going to be in the process of the exchange, of how a client is always showing us exactly what it's like to be them. And a client may present something and say, well, you know, I just don't quite know what to do next. And then our immediate, because we have the experience, we know what that person should do next. And we're tempted to say it, but if we give it back to the client, well, I understand you don't know, but what do you think about as a next step for you? Instead of taking on that function where the client becomes codependent on us, where codependency is any kind of functioning for a person that they might, could, should, or ought to be doing for themselves, as you mentioned, in full adulthood. So we give that back to the client. It may not feel as good for the moment, because it's not like we're brilliant and we have the answers, but we're being a catalyst for the client's development. It's kind of like analogous to, you know, when your child learned to tie his or her shoe. It would have been way easier to do it for them, but two things. It would have kept them from developing the nickels and dimes worth of frustration and ultimately the mastery, but they would have looked into us, the parent, as a mirror of who they really are and seen for that moment, I don't believe in you. I don't believe in your capacity to learn to tie your shoe. Here, let me do it for you. That's what our client, I believe, wants from us more than anything. I believe in you, and I'll continue that belief until both of us do it, and when I do it for myself. So that's the most important thing we can give a client, is our belief in them, because that's downloaded while we're talking about other things.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Other thoughts, concerns, things that may be helpful to go back to for the questions. I had two or three. Can I get a management of the background noise? I hear shuffling of paper. You probably are not hearing it, but when you're ready to talk, do an unmute. Are there aspects still about fee structure that some of you want to talk about money story? I had some questions, and wonder. I know my cheap lobster story didn't cover everything. Are there still questions about fee and structure, professional fee? Is there anything that might be helpful to talk about that from anyone?
Hi, Dr. Kruger. My name is Denise. I have previously had one of your your classes.
And you sent in a question. I'll keep talking to you if you call me Dave. And you sent in a question about fee structure too, right?
Yes, and the reason I ask about it, I do have a few clients, and I'm, you know, I'm blessed to say after the few years I've been doing this that the fees are, you know, not challenging for some of them that I've increased on, especially my, I've worked mostly with athletes. So, my, you know, challenge right now is I get the calls like in the middle of the week, and it'll be maybe for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, or if I'm driving, and I'm certainly not going to tell them, well, I can't talk to you until our scheduled session, you know, next Wednesday. That would be like cutting my own throat. But within that, should I consider a supplemental fee, or, you know, I just put it as a, when I'm doing my spreadsheets, I just, you know, do it as maybe a 30-minute no charge for an update or a quick session, you know, just to maintain the motivation for the client. I think that is absolutely crucial. And also, many times, like when I've pulled over on the road, I've said, well, think about where you were 3 months ago. Think about where you were last October. And look at where you are right now. Look at the questions that you're asking. And feed it back to me, you know, tell me what was on that map and tell you how you overcame it. Is this a fee or am I just being nice? I'm like, am I losing my professionalism here if I don't charge?
I would like to think about this in a different way with you and think about a structure that I think you and they could perform better and have even more optimal results. Now, first, the practical aspects. You know, you talk about the spreadsheet and entering it and that sort of thing. One thing, and this works with athletes as well as executives, and I work with both as well as other practicing and performing professionals. This is what I do with every client. One thing to consider, let me just talk this through and get to the end, so that each of you can think about it and respond. I believe the best structure for professional fees that reflects the nature of the work that we do in professional coaching is a monthly retainer. So what I suggest to a coach that I'm doing mentor coaching with, if they are still doing a sample session, is to indicate at the end of that sample session that this is a sample of a bigger issue that I think would be of significant benefit for us to work together. Here's what I would recommend, that we meet on a weekly basis, a standing time of 50 minutes each week where you call me, and two things I'd like you to do before our first standing time. Fill out the client information packet that I'll send to you in an email, and you fill it out and send it back to me before our first meeting, because that also contains the agreement. And secondly, I'll send you a link for a monthly retainer that will cover all of our sessions, plus material and resources, plus any interim contact or emails. So when I work with people, when there's going to be more than a single 50-minute time, like when I work with professional coaches, I have my lowest fee because they're not going to have emergencies. You know, you guys don't have emergencies. And so we have a standing time. It works best to have that structured as they do most with their clients. But they're at the other end of the spectrum for a significantly different fee are CEOs or athletes where I encourage people to contact me or I'll say, I would like to be able to call a second appointment. So that monthly retainer is significantly more, and it's going to cover. You won't be ambivalent about this. And it takes 10 seconds on something like a PayPal to set this up, You send them a link for a monthly retainer. They send it back. And both of you get a receipt of that every month until they unsubscribe. You don't have to keep up with invoices and do all that kind of stuff and bill. And you know, it's one monthly retainer, and it fits the nature of the work that we do and charge what you're worth. I would also say the second part is for your optimal functioning. I can't imagine that you're optimally functioning at the side of a road with cars whizzing by you at 70 miles an hour. I would think about structuring, as they will need to do, and their performance practice and performance zone, what they do in that zone will be what they do with you. I train performance coaches, so I'm very conversant with this, to say this, you know, seemingly, you know, very quickly to you, but when you work with athletes, you help them with deliberate practice and performance, and they're in a zone. If there's any distraction, if they even think one thing for a moment when they need to be in that performance zone, it's called a choke. As you know, Yogi Berra said, I can't think and hit at the same time. So do what you train your athletes to do. Get to a zone where you're going to be able to be 100%. You're not 100% at the side of that road at the response to them. I would say convert it to a structure rather than emergency. There, to me, even when I, back in the day, when I practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis, I didn't have emergencies. I don't have clients who have emergencies. An emergency to me is defined as one of my kids is bleeding. So a lack of someone's planning doesn't constitute my emergency. So I would help them structure optimum use of their time with you, just as you help them structure optimum practice. And their athletic coaches do the same thing. So create a time period that they can call you, or at least a planning ahead, instead of it being a sudden emergency. What's going to be the emergency of waiting until the end of the day when you are safely at home and have a 30-minute time that you're going to schedule two or three of these calls during that time, and you're in an optimum performance state, and you're not at your kid's basketball game or by the side of the road or responding to some emergency when you're about to walk into a restaurant? You're not 100% there, so that's why I don't do stuff like that. I want to be 100%. It's kind of like, some of you guys have heard me say this before, in Texas it would be like this. I don't want to be a fish in a lake that has water 99% of the time. I want 100%. I want my clients to have 100% of me, and I want to structure that, but more so than even anything else, I want to create a model of what they can do. When they internalize that model, it's going to be optimum effectiveness. And their careers are not going to be operating on emergencies. So that's my response to both of those. Does that make sense to you?
Totally. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Great question. I went off a little bit, so I'm afraid I've scared off anybody else to ask questions. But other thoughts, other things that might be helpful to talk about from anyone? So here's a summary, and looking at this in the simplest way, the summary of the roadmap system. We only decide three things: what we focus on, what it means, and what we do about it. These are the three steps that form the foundation of writing your story: life, money, performance. Each are decisions and shape your future. Focus, meaning, and action. So those are the things that you'll want to focus on yourself, and then look at how you can help your clients do that as well, and look at what component of, let's say you're working with somebody about a shadow money story, and a couple of the questions that I have are about the various sort of goofy decisions we make about money. First step, recognize authorship of your money story. Every choice of earning, spending, saving, investing, giving, recognize emotional triggers, recognize default me. Every component is important. If something doesn't work, look at the belief that goes into it, the behavior first, and then the belief that goes into the behavior. If it doesn't work, look at it, create something that does work. That's exactly what we do, and it's simplicity in coaching. Are there others who've sent in questions? I'm looking at my list of things. Did the discussion of fee structure, did that answer some of your questions? Or were there more questions about professional fees that would be helpful to discuss? An application to your money story. A question, how do I determine what my fee should be? Part of my issue is having the courage to set a fee and stick to it, to have the confidence to charge what I'm worth. Here's what I would suggest that you think about. Look at what you plan to charge, let's say 18 months to 2 years from now, when you have a full practice, when you have confidence, when you are doing the kind of work you need to do, what are you charging then? Then, in the morning, when you get up, set that fee structure and start charging it tomorrow morning. You don't have to have confidence is not a prerequisite. Comfort is not a prerequisite. Those are limiting presuppositions. Well, I'll do it when I feel comfortable. I'll do it when I feel confident. Do it and then feel comfortable. It's kind of like being on the edge of the swimming pool for the first time to jump in to learn to swim. You can't figure it out on paper. You got to jump in despite being uncomfortable. If you back away, it'll immediately treat the anxiety. But then the next time you get up there, you still don't know how to swim, and you'll feel even a little bit more anxious and be more inclined to back away because you've done it once already. So look at comfort and confidence as a place you get to after you learn to swim and do it for a while. It's not a place you began. It's not a prerequisite. Having 5 years of experience, having 2 degrees and all this kind of stuff, nobody yet, not a single client has ever asked me if I'm certified by ICF or if I've written a book or do I train others. Nobody's ever asked me that yet. They only want to know one thing. What's in it for them? How can I help them? That's all I focus on. I don't sell them coaching. I don't talk. We talk about them and what they want and how we're going to create a plan to get there. That's all they care about. That's exactly what they're paying you for. So when you have your money story clear, that's going to be downloaded consciously and unconsciously to them so that they can get what they're worth. I don't think I told you this. This I have an example of this. Back in the day when I was practicing psychoanalysis, because it's a 2 or 3 year process, usually somebody come in 4 times a week minimum, I would adjust my fees on a yearly basis based on inflation, and I would announce at the beginning December when I would be raising my fees in January, and I would do the same fee for everybody. So 1 year, I announced my fees in December, and one new patient, another professional, who began like in September, she was having a tough time with getting her practice going and was having a financial struggle. But I decided to do the same with her as I did everyone else, and I announced the fee increase in January. And And she paused. I knew something was up. And finally she said, in a very calm, quiet, but sort of louder voice than usual, she said, "God damn it, Kruger, why can't you ask me in the same way that you say everything else, in the considerate, calm, empathic voice that's very balanced and very caring, why can't you ask me for more money in the same way without pausing and hesitating and acting like you're doing something to me? How in the world do you expect me to go out there and get what I'm worth if you can't tell me that you want $5 more for each session?" And I knew she was absolutely, she said, "Would you like to try that again?" And I paused, took a breath, told her in the same way that I told everyone else. She said, "Thank you. I'll be happy to pay you $5 more a session. Now, let's get back to my analysis." She said that in a very elegant and very informed way because she was downloading a model of something that was new to her. And she expected me to get there before her and show her how to do it, although that's not what we were talking about. You know, the guy that started this whole business of professional coaching said, you know, after all, we just have to be one step ahead of our clients. Remember that. That's all you have to do, one step ahead of your clients. Anything else before we stop? We're over a little bit from what I said we'd do, and I appreciate you guys sticking with me. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? And I promise I'll be brief.
I'd like to ask you if you're going to be brief. My name is Alex. Hello, David. And I just would like to ask you how basketball has changed your life.
How what?
How basketball has changed your life.
How basketball has changed my life. How did you know that?
Well, you seems like you like basketball. I guess you like it still.
Okay.
Still, I believe it changed this house somehow.
One of my two primary mentors in growing up was my coach, who coached me 4 years in basketball and was a mentor and really was as important as my dad and was the determinant of why I went into my two careers to help other people. I have a new book coming out about, you know, peak performance playbook for, you know, for coaches, mentors, and I have some stories about him. He even taught me how to deal with success anticlimax, because one of the things we have one of the things you will each predict, and this is the subject of what I'm about to do, research, writing, interviews and stuff for our next book, is about how to handle extreme success. He taught me how to handle extreme success, as well as mentoring and balancing a whole number of things. We got on a bus after winning the first tournament, and I was a freshman, and I was intimidated by all the upperclassmen, but we were excited about going home and going downtown to the parade, and you know, he said, "Okay, we won our first tournament. Now, it's kind of a podunk tournament. How many of you are actually proud of winning that tournament?" And, man, my hand would have shot up so fast, but I was afraid to raise one finger. None of the 12 people, the other 11 guys on that bus, raised a finger. And he said, "Well, you did good. Congratulations. Let's go home now and work on being a really excellent team." And that's success anticlimax, because you have to wonder when you get to the top, what's next? You know, Bruce Jenner asked after 4 decades of running the decathlon, the day after he retired the next morning, he got up and said, "What am I going to do the rest of my life now?" So that's an important aspect. So, you know, he taught me one thing. It's summarized in keep your eye on the ball and your head in the game. That's exactly what we do in coaching. We focus and we keep an eye on the system. I couldn't say it any simpler. When you combine that with my favorite grandmother's saying, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. So those are the two people who had most ongoing influence. So does that sort of answer your question?
Thank you. That was great.
Okay.
That was really great. I like
yeah.
it a lot. And congratulations on coming up on your book.
Thank you. And that would be the two governing principles of any decision I would make is, could I tell this to Mammy, my favorite grandmother? And if I could, then it was a go. If I ran this by a coach, he would tell me yes or no, and that would be it. If it was a thing, it was a no, or if it was that was yes or no. So those were the two metrics of any major decision I would make, and I would have that conversation with them longer than I'm willing to admit in many ways. So thank you all for attending, and I give a medal to those of you who are sticking with me to the very end here. I hope it's been helpful. I appreciate all of your input, interaction, energy, and kind words. I hope this has been helpful. And if I can be of help to you, let me know. See you guys. Thanks again. Bye now.
Thank you.
See you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Absolutely.